Welcome Underground. We've both been reading In Praise of Shadows, a 1930s essay on aesthetics by Japanese man of letters Junichiro Tanizaki. It provoked in us a meandering variety of thoughts on technology, change, interior design, literature, and Werner Herzog. We will share these with you over the course of the next hour. Enjoy.
This was recommended to me by my Kindle after I read The Ruin of Cash by Roberto Colasso, which is an entirely different podcast, one that would be very freeform and confusing. So that's a very freeform and confusing book.
Oh, you mentioned that one. It's only freeform and confusing,
Brilliant, though. I mean, I think. I don't really know.
Well, it's also much about the work itself. It's about the thoughts that the work sets off in your mind, which is what I found about In Praise of Shadows as well.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So, Kindle was like, you like that, did you? I want some of this. In Praise of Shadows. And I saw the title, In Praise of Shadows, and I thought, that's a winning title. What a great title. How laden with promise and enticement is that? And it was free on Kindle Unlimited, so I was like, brilliant. I'm living in the perfect world. So I downloaded it and I read it in one sitting, actually, which is something I rarely do these days.
As did I. I mean, in fairness, it's not a long work. It's achievable.
All right. Still, did it in one sitting. It's difficult when you've got a job and you've got a child and you've got all kinds of things going on. Anyway.
I bought a physical copy at your recommendation and it's 70 pages, but that's quite chill pages.
It's quite chill.
Generously spaced. Yeah.
It's and just
it was
a chill.
Good. So Kindle.
It was good. It was good.
Kindle did solid.
Yeah, it did. The Kindle algorithm came up with the goods. I read it without knowing anything about the author. I just dove straight into it. I only looked up when it was written. I kind of zeroed in on the time in which it was written as I was reading it. I actually thought it was going to be written in the 50s. It's actually written in the 30s.
Yeah, it's got that kind of... It doesn't have the Second World War hanging over it in a way that Sun and Steel does, which is quite a similar book in its own way. Mm. Another literary man chopsing off about something slightly adjacent to what he normally does.
Yeah, and apparently this was quite a normal thing in Japan to get sort of famous literary figures to just write down their thoughts on this and that.
I believe there's a whole thing about people doing long pieces for magazines and things like that. That you just commission your literary gentleman to write 20,000 words on whatever's on his mind.
I really approve of that, Japan. Well done. Mm. And the author here is Junichiro Tanizaki. And apologies to all our Japanese listeners if I pronounced that terribly. But he seems to be a pretty big cheese in Japanese literature in the 20th century. To my shame, I had not heard of him before.
Me neither.
He's a big deal. He's written some very famous works. He was translated, I think, in the 70s into English. Just seems like an all-around pretty sound guy. He was the first Japanese author to be honored by the American Academy and the National Institute of Arts and Letters. Now, that happened in 1965, and he was born in 1886. So this guy has lived a really interesting life, if you think about it. I mean, being born in 1886 in Japan... the Meiji Restoration has happened. They're about 20 years into this kind of crash modernization program of turning from a feudal, medieval style society with that kind of technological level, more or less, into a modern industrial society that can take on, say, Russia in a few years' time and win the Russo-Japanese War. So a time of absolutely astonishing change in Japan. And it doesn't let up, does it, for his whole life? Because
it gets worse.
It just the sort of roller coaster just gets faster and faster. He lives through all of the wars in the 20s and 30s, and Second World War, of course, the American occupation, and you know, he's still alive in sort of, you know, the 60s. And I mean, how different is life in 1960s Japan from life in 1886 Japan? I mean, that's just mind-blowing, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah.
So worth getting his thoughts in the sort of nicely in the midpoint of that process in 1933, which is when this was written in Praise of Shadows. And it's about architecture, I guess. Aesthetics.
Well, I mean, aesthetics in general, yeah. So there's a bit on architecture. I mean, it seems to be a sort of series of vignettes, perhaps eight separate reflections. I've been using the word vignettes a lot after Artem's episode, What is Money?
My wife just quite picked up on the use of vignettes in that episode, and she loves it. She wants Artem to come and say, come and say vignettes at her about, you know, all day. She also proclaimed, I love Artem, quite out of the blue, in the car, which I thought was a revelation. So she's got a bit of a crush on old Artem, I'm afraid. and his use of the word vignettes. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I interrupted you. Vignettes.
Yeah, it's a useful tool. And yeah, telling little stories that illustrate a wider point and help you find a way into a difficult subject. And this book is basically eight different vignettes on different elements of Japanese aesthetics. So yeah, some of it is architecture and how Japanese houses are built, but some of it's on things like Japanese loos, Japanese crockery. There's a lament about technology and how it's all been built on sort of Western assumptions. What else?
There's some interesting things about men, I think. Beautiful women as well.
Yeah.
What beauty consists of for women in the sort of Japanese versus the Western perspective, which I think that is probably the more controversial end of the reflections, only in the modern context, but
a lot of comparisons of Japanese to white people seem to trouble the author a bit.
He's quite sort of he's perfectly frank about that, isn't he? I mean, he talks about things like skin color in the context of aesthetics, you know, quite frankly, without any apparent embarrassment, which is a bit discombobulating from the sort of the modern dominant ideological framework that says that basically only sort of wicked Westerners in the past would have done that. So that's interesting. What really hooked me into it was that he starts with the loo. He starts just talking about toilets. which is quite interesting. And he said that, he's talking about how he loves Japanese toilets because they are, well, they tend to be outside of the house. They tend to be sort of fairly open to nature and they tend to be sort of dirty. You know, they're not white and pristine and sort of in quotation marks, hygienic like Western toilets. They're not lit. They are places of reflection and harmony with, one's body and the wider natural world. Don't know whether I'm using natural world in quite the right way there, but the Western aesthetics of the bathroom, as it were, are all about gleaming hygiene and sort of probing light. You want to be able to see the gleaming white surfaces everywhere.
Yeah, it's not just hygiene, but the clear appearance of hygiene. I think his argument was that your traditional Japanese lavatory was very clean, but you couldn't really see it because it was all dark and made of wood. And it relied on a lot of active cleaning to keep it so. And so you didn't need that reassurance that it was clean, which sparkling white porcelain gives you. I don't know what a Japanese lavatory is actually made of. He seemed to say wood or like lacquered or something.
Yeah, I think he talks a lot about lacquer. So I'm going to say that yes, it was probably lacquered.
Wood lavatory.
Lacquered wood. Yeah. And I guess that is a good way in for his whole kind of reflection on aesthetics, which is that the Western aesthetic is actually very, very different from the traditional Japanese aesthetic. And this is the Japanese aesthetic that existed before the Meiji Restoration, which is the decision in, I think, 1867 to industrialize and compete with the Western powers. And so import Western institutions and ideological frameworks and technology and but integrate them into a sort of Japanese context, you know, very, very consciously and agentically. And of course, he's old enough to remember a time when that transition was happening. And I guess it still kind of is happening in 1933. So
yeah.
The old Japan is very much sitting there with the new Japan sort of growing on it like a sort of, you know, like a sort of fungus or something. he's lamenting the passing of this prior aesthetic. And, the essence of that aesthetic is captured in the title, isn't it? It's In Praise of Shadows. And it's the idea that before the technology, the electric lights, before Western, aesthetic ideals, Japanese aesthetic ideals, because the technology limited them in certain ways, out of that technological soil grew the aesthetics and a particular conception of beauty, and one that was forced to have darkness as a part of it, and so lent into that and produced a wonderful aesthetic based around a kind of manipulation of the dark spaces, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And by the manipulation of darkness, he sort of talks of Japanese houses, which generally have much heavier eaves and no glass, paper instead. And so there's a lot more of a play of light. It's much more shadowy inside the house, but B, the light that does come in has a certain quality to it. And then they build the houses around capturing and making the most of that quality using natural materials and, light being filtered through paper,
perhaps
the alcoves. Yeah.
Perhaps I can quote him. Sorry to cut you off. I'm just ashamed of my own inadequacy in putting into words what he's saying. Perhaps we can quote him. Put him in his own words. He says, "The quality that we call beauty, however, must always grow from the realities of life, and our ancestors, forced to live in dark rooms, presently came to discover beauty in shadows." Ultimately to guide shadows towards beauty's ends. And I think as the listener can hear there, he is perfectly capable of putting it much more succinctly and clearly than I am.
We were struggling.
And that's the essence of it really, isn't it? Which is a very lovely thought.
Yeah, so the contrast is between like a Japanese temple, which is all very dark and heavy, and a Gothic cathedral, which is built to bring as much light in as possible.
Mm.
And ditto, Japanese houses tend to have heavy eaves and paper windows, whilst British houses in particular have very narrow eaves and big windows. So the idea is to get as much light in as possible, whilst in Japan, whether it's through the building materials or whatever, there's just a lot less light in the house.
Yeah. I found perfect, really quite engrossing was his really quite... well, engaging descriptions of what it would be like to be in a dark Japanese house. And I'm going slightly out of sequence here, but there's another sort of longer quotation, which I think is worth jumping to, because, here he's bringing in his reflections on the aesthetics of women in ancient Japan as well. So I'm sort of jumping the gun a little bit, but I think that I think it's worth quoting this because it's, I think it's so good.
Mm.
He says, "Smaller rooms are the fashion now, and even if one were to use candles in them, one would not get the colour of that darkness. But in the old palace and the old house of pleasure, the ceilings were high, the skirting corridors were wide, the rooms themselves were usually tens of feet long and wide, and the darkness must always have pressed in like a fog. The elegant aristocrat of old was immersed in this suspension of ashen particles, soaked in it. But the man of today, long used to electric light, has forgotten that such a darkness existed. It must have been simple for spectres to appear in a visible darkness, where always something seemed to be flickering and shimmering, a darkness that on occasion held greater terrors than darkness out of doors. This was the darkness in which ghosts and monsters were active, and indeed, was not the woman who lived in it, behind thick curtains, behind layer after layer of screens and doors, was she not a kind with them? The darkness wrapped her round tenfold, twentyfold, It filled the collar, the sleeves of her kimono, the folds of her skirt, wherever a hollow invited. Further yet, might it not have been the reverse? Might not the darkness have emerged from her mouth and those black teeth, from the black of her hair, like the thread from the great earth spider? What a great piece of writing that is.
Mm.
And his integration there of the aesthetics of the traditional Japanese female and the traditional Japanese house, I think is a real imaginative feat that he conjures really, really nicely, such that, you know, even I, a Westerner living a sort of 100 years later, can be sort of engrossed in it and drawn into it.
Yeah, and actually just that description of the darkness that's around you if you're in a big, dark room. Yeah, that does have a very different quality that I never really thought about before than darkness outside. They are more interesting shadows.
Yeah, and he talks a lot, doesn't he, about the use of candles in those big, dark spaces and how the candles will have interacted with the... even things like the type of bowls used. So this is where he's talking about lacquerware again. He says, you know, under electric lights, lacquerware looks very cheap and rubbish. But under candlelight in a dark room, it looks mysterious and fantastic.
Yeah, and ditto, the gold thread that makes up the sort of Japanese priest outfits traditionally, or even the no theatre costumes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they look really tacky in bright light, but they look incredible in dim light.
And he has this astonishing part as well about the green lipstick of the geisha, which I really like. I mean, will you indulge me another quotation?
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
He says, "What fascinates me most of all, however, is that green iridescent lipstick so rarely used today, even by Kyoto geisha. One can guess nothing of its power unless one imagines it in the low, unsteady light of a candle. The woman of old was made to hide the red of her mouth under green-black lipstick, to put shimmering ornaments in her hair, and so the last trace of colour was taken from her rich skin. I know of nothing whiter than the face of a young girl in the wavering shadow of a lantern, her teeth now and then as she smiles shining a lacquered black through lips like elfin fires. It is whiter than the whitest white woman I can imagine. The whiteness of the white woman is clear, tangible, familiar. It is not this otherworldly whiteness. Perhaps the latter does not even exist. Perhaps it is only a mischievous trick of light and shadow, a thing of moment only, but even so, it is enough. We can ask for nothing more." So again, very nicely written.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we do a lot better just reading it out.
Yeah, probably.
And not really talking about yeah. it. But
there you can see as well in that, he's quite frank discussions of sort of skin colour and things like that, that, you know, we might sort of take a double take at in the modern world. You know, he's quite open about discussing it and, you know, talking about it and comparing the Japanese skin tone to the what he calls the white skin tone.
Yeah, but there's a lot of comparison throughout the book. I mean, one of his laments is that it was the West that came up with all this new technology that got implemented in Japan. And he says that if Japan had got there first, or if Japan hadn't come in contact with the West and therefore eventually got around to creating these technologies itself, they would be built around Japanese assumptions and Japanese aesthetics and would therefore take a completely different form that would be much more... it would work a lot better with the Japanese traditional aesthetics and way of life. Even like physics, he says, you know, all the models of physics are based on a very Western way of seeing the world, of categorizing and putting in pigeonholes and things like that. And maybe if Japan had got there first, it would have a lot more nuance about it, a lot more of a sense of impermanence. And actually, you know, rolling that forwards, while I think you get onto Newtonian physics a lot quicker if you're using Western assumptions.
Yeah, quantum.
Now we're onto, yeah, exactly. Mm, yeah. Quantum physics, I think, would be a lot easier to understand if you're coming from a Japanese point of view. And it's just unfortunate that we got the low-hanging fruit in the West, and so now we're trying to build on top of a framework that I don't think is the best.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've read, you know, physicists who write for the popular market on quantum mechanics who explicitly say that the only real way to comprehend what's going on in quantum is to adopt a sort of Eastern philosophical view, as it were, and talk about how, you know, it's all about impermanence and relationships between things rather than the things itself, which apparently is, you know, deeply woven into many Eastern philosophies.
Shinto in particular, and Yeah, that love of impermanence comes within the book. The idea that you admire something beautiful not just for what it is now and what it looks like now, but what it has been and what it will become. Like a bud is more beautiful than a flower because you're seeing, you know, the bare sticks it was and the flower will be it will become. Everything is emerging from its potential or returning to a state of potential. Mm. It's never static. Nothing's forever.
Mm.
And they embrace that.
Great stuff. Top stuff. Loved it. And this is why I've spent the last couple of weeks daydreaming about designing my own house. because, I don't know, I would I design it as a sort of a some kind of weird Japanese pastiche? I mean, that would be awful, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be absolutely shockingly terrible. And that's what's interesting
Well, amusingly, in my edition of In Praise of Shadows, A, it clearly tones down the brothel stuff a bit compared to yours.
Mm.
So it might be slightly bowdlerized. I think it's a 1970s translation. But the other thing is, in the afterword, it tells a story of when Tanizaki was getting a new house built in the 60s.
Mm.
And the architect came around and said, oh, yeah, I read In Praise of Shadows. I know exactly what you want. And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't actually want to live in that. It was more of a, more of a theoretical.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it? Well, as he says, you know, the aesthetics have to grow out of the realities of daily life. And if the realities of daily life have changed, then unfortunately you do have to let the aesthetics go or allow them to change.
Yeah, as he says, like a tiled bathroom is like just far better objectively in every way apart from the aesthetics than a wooden one.
Mm.
And he regrets this, but says it's the truth. And that was one of those things where, yeah, if Japan had actually invented these technologies, it probably would have been different and been more aesthetically pleasing. But because the West got there first and we like white porcelain and light, that's where we ended up.
It's such an interesting question, isn't it? Whether that is true, whether the technology would have taken on subtly different forms if it had sprung from a different sort of cultural ground. I just don't know what to think about that. I don't know how one would decide that question. I suppose you would have to look at technologies that have been invented separately, you know, sort of polygenesis in different places, you know, independently. And I mean, I suppose you can do that quite easily, really, can't you? You can look at look at the sword, for example. Mm. That's a kind of classic thing which people think about when they think of Japan. Look at European swords, tend to be
the big broad swords,
heavy, straight. Yeah. Bit brittle. Whereas the Japanese, enormous. The Japanese swords are subtle, curved. You know, they require more art to wield and to make. So I suppose that, examples like that would suggest that actually it would take on a subtly different form coming from a different cultural context, which is just a fascinating,
The example you use, if I remember correctly, was fountain pens, where in the West we've always used pens because that's just how our writing system works and what we got used to. Whilst in the East they would use brushes for calligraphy. And he's like, if we'd got there first, the fountain pen would have a brush on it, like the ink would run down the bristles, and then us in the West would have had to adapt to that.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me actually of the old, outside context problem in Ian M. Banks, where, of course, this is his sort of phrase where he says that you're going along, chugging along quite happily in your own sort of cultural and technological context. And then if somebody rocks up on the beach, you know, from a completely different and more efficient or productive or powerful technological context, then you're just absolutely stuffed because they are an outside context problem. They're from outside of your context. So you have absolutely no idea of how to deal with them. And you either adapt or you die.
Yeah.
And the Japanese, of course, experienced this very, very brutally with the contact from the Western powers. And they chose to adapt. And lamenting for what might have been if it had been the other way around, I think is a typically sophisticated and nuanced Japanese response to that.
Yeah. Yeah, accepting the world for what it is.
Yeah. So it's happened. Yeah. No, there's no good crying about it. But...
Yeah.
I mean,
nice.
It's what's astonishing to me about the whole Meiji Restoration thing is the how the Japanese were able to do that. I mean, can you imagine?
You've got to see the world very clearly to execute.
You've got to be very clear-eyed and very disciplined.
Yeah.
Which is it's probably one of the most astonishing civilizational achievements ever, I'd say. Yeah. Actually,
undoubtedly.
Yeah. So actually, no, we're not going to be the victim like so many other, peoples around the world. Yeah. We are going to adapt and we are going to...
And we're going to master it.
We're going to master it and we're going to be the ones kicking ass. Now, it didn't turn out that well, that particular line of thought. But they gave it a good go.
They certainly did. And then even with the blip of the Second World War.
Yeah.
I mean, the economy is great.
Got a bit of a birth rate problem now, but...
Well, I mean, they're not alone in that.
No, they're not. I mean, so do we.
Yep.
It's not quite as advanced as theirs, but still bad. Yeah, I mean, so... But I guess that... There's this whole kind of other discussion, isn't there, about Western counter fascination with Japan, where we are drawn to it culturally because it is. I don't know, why aren't we drawn to Japan? Because it retains. But the irony about Japan is that while it chose to adapt to and integrate all of these kind of Western vectors of power, technology, institution, blah 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 blah. It did it on its own terms, and that's what it gained from doing this. It wasn't forced upon Japan in a direct sense. I mean, they were forced into that situation where they had to make that choice, but they very much decided, no, we are going to proactively do this so that we can do it in a Japanese way. And the ironic result of that has been that Japan has retained a cultural distinctiveness. I mean, I would argue far more than most other cultures around the world that have become, in quotation marks, westernized.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, given how close they are now in the American orbit.
Yeah. But actually, incredibly culturally distinctive to the extent where Japanese culture is a sort of a globally recognized brand that stands out, very well in the global
context. And
it's
brilliant. I mean, Studio Ghibli runs rings around Disney.
I actually watched Spirited Away the other day.
How'd you find it? It's so good.
I mean, I watched it when I was a teenager because my friend recommended it to me. He was obsessed with Japan. As people do. I mean, you do meet people who are just obsessed with Japan. Yeah. And you think...
What's the word? Weeaboo, I think, is the...
Oh, well, I don't know. Well, Okay. I mean, the fact that, most of us will have met someone who is just like really just into Japan. I mean, how often do you meet someone who... I mean, I don't want to be insulting to other countries here. I mean, I'd put Britain in this bracket, right? But how many people do you meet who are just like obsessed with, I don't know, Mexico or Canada or
France?
France. Like, but very few, I think it's fair to say. Whereas with Japan, it's quite frequent that you find people who are just into it. I think that speaks to an enduring sort of cultural power. And that's not a particular...
Well, and I get it, because when you watch something, it's kind of relatable or high quality enough to be engaging, whilst at the same time being completely bizarre.
Yeah, and I mean, Spirited Away is an absolute prime example of that. You feel very much as if you are in a completely different place, and yet somehow you connect with it on an emotional level.
Yeah,
you get it, exactly. And you like, this makes no sense on that superficial level. There are some like heads rolling around and this woman is a bird and also a smaller bird at the same time. And I don't know what's going on, but on an emotional level, I'm connecting with it. And I know that it's playing all the right emotional notes in me in a very, very effective way. And that's a really weird experience, but also thrilling and fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. And it gets even more extreme in some of the other Miyazaki films. Did you watch The Boy and the Heron, the most recent one?
No.
And that is a complete trip. And like most of it's just completely impenetrable. I assume it'll hit me like a ton of bricks when I'm 60 or something. But at the same time, you get it.
I've got to do it then. I've got to watch that, The Boy and the Heron.
I mean, it's a weird film.
And I don't know, I feel like when I was reading In Praise of Shadows, I suppose what I found so engrossing about it was that I was able to envisage myself as this sort of feudal Japanese aristocrat in his dark house. Yeah. No, I really could, I could put myself there, and I, it was almost like I understood it, but at the same time, it's very alien. And that's what's, you know, I guess that's the...
I mean, there's some say that, like, the fundamentals of Japan, like, geographically, are quite similar to the UK, where you're a small island off a, you know, major continental power, similar climate.
I think they're quite superficial, though, because Britain is, what, 20 miles away from France, which Japan is 100 miles away, I think, over 100 miles at its closest point. Mm. So actually, there's a threshold there that's being crossed where you have to have a completely different technology level to cross that sea. So the isolation is much more profound.
Yeah, you can't swim it, yeah.
And also, I think that it's 50% bigger, actually, the Japanese landmass, with it's much more fertile. So it's always had a much bigger population. So it's been...
Well, it's fertile where it's fertile, but a lot of it's mountains that you can't do anything with.
Yes, but it's always had a much bigger population than Britain because of the combination of those two things.
That's a rice thing, isn't it? Or like, rice is just a much more efficient staple food than wheat.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. Which meant that all the kind of cities in the Far East were historically much larger than anything in Europe until...
Yeah, well, yeah. I guess, though, that also another difference is that Japan has always faced a continent that has always more or less been dominated by a single power, i.e. China. Mm. Whereas we've always faced a continent that has been divided between multiple powers. And so actually the
partly
role...
Partly because we work hard to maintain that, but...
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And for me, the big difference is the fact that Japan's trying to kill everyone in it all the time, all the volcanoes and earthquakes and tsunamis, which have got to do something to the psyche.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think that... have you ever read Shogun?
No. People keep saying I ought to.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah.
Absolutely love Shogun. Shogun is great. Yeah, it's really good. yeah, Shogun is from back when you could get these kind of Western novelists writing about, you know, exotic, in quotation marks, faraway places in quite an unselfconscious way. But the thing is that Clavell, who wrote it, James Clavell... He clearly did his research. Like, this isn't some sort of, I don't know, Orientalist. Well, I'm sure you can find scholars who say it is Orientalist. But I don't. It's not a work that's done out of ignorance or prurience or anything like that. It's
I'd also argue that to explain, you know, a Japanese cultural context to a Western audience, I'd say that a well-read-up Westerner is going to be able to translate that more effectively than a Japanese person.
Yeah. What I would say about it is it's done clearly with an enormous amount of respect and admiration and fascination with the Japanese culture. It's not done with in any respect. There is not even a single hint of contempt about anything he writes about Japan. So even though he is, you know, very much drawing in on the sort of the stuff that's going to shock and appall and titillate, it's nevertheless, you know, done with a certain, you know, awe and respect, which I think makes it perfectly fine. In a personal view.
Yeah. And as discussed with Japan, you're not punching down.
You
can see them as equals.
Quite significant superiors. And I think that that's the theme that runs through Shogun, which is that, you know, you have this kind of Elizabethan Englishman rock up on the shores of Japan, totally looking down his nose at them, thinking that they're savages, and yet being absolutely schooled in how he is the savage. and the reader is being schooled at the same time, which I think makes it quite a progressive text. There you go. Yeah. Quite different from In Praise of Shadows, Shogun, but a great read. Very much.
Useful comparison. And of course, you know, I say, okay, a Westerner who's well-schooled in Japan is better at communicating in Japan, but actually, In Praise of Shadows communicates Japanese aesthetics better than any Westerner I could come across.
Yeah, and I guess that you have one of the other things that's fascinating about Japan because of its particular history is you have this kind of really nicely balanced two-way communication, because you have Westerners who are fascinated by Japan and seek to explore it and explain it. But you also have, you know, the Japanese who have become inculcated in so much of Western culture, looking at it from the other direction and trying to explain it to themselves and to other Japanese and to Westerners. And so you have this kind of dialogue emerging. And I would see that in people like, you know, like Murakami, love Murakami. Mm. And some of the stuff that he writes, you know, his early novels like Pinball, which is about the, you know, young man who falls in love with a pinball machine. and you say, you know, a few years ago, he would have fallen in love with his torpedo bomber. But now, you know, he's falling in love with a pinball machine, and pinball machine, in a, you know, part, at least part of that metaphor I see is, you know, with its flashing lights and sort of garish superficiality is a sort of a cipher for something slightly Western.
Also, I mean, again, if you're writing in the 30s, talking about Japanese aesthetics, you are kind of an outsider as well, because you're looking back. Yes, it's within living memory, but it's a very different world you're describing to the one you're living in today. So you've already got a bit of that context as an outsider. I think there are a few books written around then. There's one called The Book of Tea by, I've got it here, Okakura Kakuzo, which is, again, a sort of treatise on Japanese aesthetics written, I think it was written for the benefit of an American audience, probably 10 years before In Praise of Shadows. Mm. And again, he does a really good job in kind of saying what the vibe is. And creating these vignettes. And he's writing as an outsider because it's no longer the world he lives in.
Mm.
But it means that what he's writing is readily understood by a foreign audience.
Mm. I think it's... there's something in that is so interesting, is that being an outsider, if everyone becomes a sort of an outsider in their own culture when something changes, something really fundamental changes, then suddenly we're all... dislocated, you know. So for the Japanese, you know, as soon as you know, Commander or Commodore, whatever he was, Perry rocks up in Edo Bay with his sort of steamships and his cannons and all of that kind of thing, like, it's almost like from that moment, it's a really, what's the, one of the things that's so interesting about that is that it's such a definite moment in time. And, you know, there's before that and there's after that.
Yeah.
And it's almost like action at a distance in sort of quantum mechanics, where there's something that's faster than light that has happened. Because even if you're living in a remote area in Japan and you have no idea that, you know, the steamship has sailed into Edo Bay, nevertheless, it still applies to you. There was something has changed and you have no idea. But from that moment, you are no longer living in the same Japan. And isn't that just fascinating? And that after that, you have ontologically shifted, and you're now looking, you're now trying to, if you were to just, from that moment, sitting in a traditional Japanese house doing traditional Japanese things, that's now got that adjective, traditional, whereas before it was world.
It was just Japanese, yeah.
But now it's got this adjective, traditional.
It wasn't even just Japanese, it was everything.
It was everything, it was just the world.
Yeah.
But now it's a traditional Japanese thing, and that puts it in a completely different aesthetic and ontological footing and excludes you from it. You can't truly inhabit it. You're always sort of a spectating yourself doing it, because it's got that element of pastiche suddenly, because it's no longer the world.
Yeah. You're not being honest if you stick to it. Yeah.
And to bring it back to, you know, the reflections on, you know, what would I do building my own house? I often, you know,
speaking of pastiche.
I mean, that's the risk, isn't it? That you just end up doing a pastiche. People like us who are interested in history and different cultures and, you know, different concepts and experimentation and things like that, you just end up doing something absolutely absurd. I mean, so I would, probably.
But I think you can take some realistic lessons from In Praise of Shadows and apply them even to a normal house. Just light and how you treat light in a house. I was reading someone commenting on, so at the moment, like, the lighting in films is really flat and bland. It's very rare for a blockbuster to have kind of dramatic lighting or dynamic lighting or opinionated lighting. And this person posited that the reason was that actually all our houses and all our offices, all our workplaces, our schools are so much lighter now than they were in the 80s. Like, you've got bright light sources, lots of them, but actually we're used to quite flat light, and so we don't even know what dramatic lighting looks like anymore, because we're not exposed to it day to day. And so the films from like 40 years ago, where there was a lot more light and shadow and directional light and dim light and colored light, it just looks a lot better because you have all that, and people are used to it.
I also I kind of see it as the dominant aesthetic at the moment in the when you look at prestige aesthetics in the West, the aesthetics of prestige are extremely bland. You know, it's kind of charcoals and beiges and very bloodless. I'd almost describe it as Scandi. I don't know whether that's a bit of a sort of a cliche or a
Scandi's got a bit of that sort of natural materials vibe going on. You've got the wood and things like that. Whilst what's the prestige aesthetic in the UK? It doesn't even have that really.
No, it's a sort of a matte charcoal at the moment, isn't it? But yeah, very. And the more regularity there is, the less sort of elaboration there is in the aesthetic, the more prestige it is. I think it's very minimalist and colourless.
Yeah, I mean, the theory there is that it used to be that ornamentation was prestigious because it was difficult and expensive to make, whilst now it's cheap and easy to make ornamentation with mass manufacturing. And so it's lost that exclusivity because anyone can have it. And so then what becomes exclusive is having no ornamentation at all, because that's actually a bit harder to put off.
Yeah. Yes, sort of reducing the shape to its most fundamental form is actually harder when you've got a complicated bit of machinery that's being squeezed into it, I guess. So actually that becomes the thing that's...
Like, it's incredible an iPhone is so boring.
Yeah. 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 All right, yeah. It's interesting.
But it means that, the thing I would take from this into house design is to have weird lighting. Have pools of light and shadow, have lights in weird places, have dim lights, have various lighting options.
Yeah. He talks a lot about, and I cut you off earlier, sorry, when you were talking about to talk about alcoves, which I regret because I think I loved his section on alcoves in Praise of Shadows. He's saying, an alcove is designed to be in shadow and they would be terrifying back in the day and they'd be great. That'd be, be brilliant. And you'd have something in an alcove which sort of be half visible and it would sort of emerge atmospherically from the shadows.
Yeah, and it'd be like the one bit of ornamentation in the entire room is this object or painting in this alcove.
I was just saying that, maybe that's something that I would try and integrate into a house I was designing. Some atmospheric alcoves.
The best alcove story I came across was in The Book of Tea, again, this one by Kakuzo, written 10 years earlier, which was talking of some sage in some village somewhere who had this, he lived in the middle of this large field of really beautiful flowers. This field of flowers was really famous, and the local shogun or something heard about it and decided to visit. And all very exciting. Shogun came and found that the sage had ploughed up the entire field. There were no flowers. It just destroyed them all. And the shogun was really annoyed at this because he'd come all the way to see the flowers. And then went into the tea house with the sage and saw that in the alcove, just in a little vase, was one flower, which was the best of the entire field of flowers, just in the alcove. And it just blew everyone's minds. But I mean, an incredible statement of what Japanese aesthetics is all about. But also good use of an alcove.
Yeah. Nice vignette as well.
Vignette.
Good job. Got that one in there. Yeah. Was it the shogun or was it a daimyo?
Memory fails me. Yeah. I read this a long time ago.
Right. I just wanted to get my one bit of sort of...
Yeah, so, yeah.
Legit Japanese knowledge. Yeah, no. Just well, all that in there. I don't actually know whether that's the right question to ask at all. It's just, I ought to know more about it. Great vignette. Love it. Well, I mean, have we covered everything in sort of Praise of Shadows?
Well, I mean, yeah. We can talk more of Shadows. Because the other thing that came to mind when I was reading it, along with the idea that films are so boring because there's just too much neutral light everywhere, was I was also recently reading Werner Herzog's autobiography, called Every Man for Himself and God Against All, and it's an incredible book. I'm an enormous Werner Herzog fanboy. I love his documentaries and films, and I really enjoyed this book. Like he lived really, really strange life. But at one bit, he's talking about therapy and psychoanalysis.
Mm.
And he absolutely hates it. I've got a quote actually here. So I don't know if I should do it in his accent, but I believe that explaining every dark little corner that we have in our soul is very unhealthy and a very stupid and a very dangerous thing. We should not do that. Why? Because when you inhabit a house and you illuminate every last corner of the house with strong lights, the house becomes uninhabitable. And human beings illuminated to the very last corner of their darkest soul become inhuman and uninhabitable. And I kind of agreed with that.
Like, yeah, yeah. I love that. Love that. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree
and
more.
So, yeah.
And I think that you can see from the development of psychoanalysis as a kind of cultural force in the early 1900s in the West, a very, very destructive. I mean, obviously, this is not a falsifiable statement. This is just a kind of a grand sweeping statement based on almost no evidence at all, other than my own sort of perception and intuition. But I would say that you can put a lot of the sort of what we would think of as the ills of the Western man, as it were, down to that tendency. The idea that you can dig, you should dig into all the shadows and unearth them and get them out in front and sort of, you know, lay them out on the table and turn over all the rocks and, you know, do all that. I think it's an absolutely terrible, terrible idea.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with him more.
But again, in the house, yeah.
Yeah, and such a good little link there. Bravo. Yeah. Really Thank nice. You. Really nice. Nicely done. Yeah, and it works perfectly, doesn't it? Because a house, you know, we inhabit a house in the same way that we inhabit our body. It becomes a sort of an extension of us. It's a, you know, it's an extended space that, you know, becomes, is very much part of our, you know, we're like hermit crabs with our shells, aren't we? Is the shell part of the organism or is it sort of like separate from the organism? And we're a bit like that with our houses because we can't survive without them. And,
yeah, partly that. And also how you create your house, it ends up being an extension of your mind. Like the different aesthetics of different rooms put you in different moods to do different things.
Yeah.
What you see around you is what's at the top of your mind. Like actually a beautiful painting will create certain thoughts in you when you're around it.
Mm.
And so the aesthetics of your house, I think, have an enormous part to play in your life. So you're absolutely right to think about building a house and
yeah, it's kind of like it's almost like a mold in which your sort of mind dwells, isn't it? The house.
Yeah.
It's the parameters, it's the ground that shapes it. So in the same way that the aesthetics of the house will grow out of the soil of the reality of your culture or your civilization, if it is not to be a pastiche, your mind is also shaped by that space because, of course, you're living in it.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite a big deal.
It's worth putting all thought into. Anything you would add as well as creative lighting to your house that's not a pastiche, but informed by?
I think that it's really important with a house that you understand it, that it's not a thing that sort of scares you or has things that are unknown in terms of the way that it works.
Mm.
I feel like if there's something about your house where you don't understand it or it frightens you, you don't want to kind of look in it because you're afraid that you might find a hole in the roof or a sort of, you know, a leak in the pipe or something like that. I don't think that's good. I think that you have to feel like the house is an extension of yourself. And
you
can rely on it. And in a sense, you have ownership of it. And what I mean by that is that you understand each nook and cranny of it in the same way that you understand the way that your own body works and you understand, you know, its extent and its boundaries and what it looks like. I think it's, you know, what I would say is it took me too long in the house or the flat that I have now to work up the courage to poke into all of the little corners in the sort of the attic and all under the cupboards and, you know, and all around the backs of the wardrobes.
Work out where the stopcock is.
Of that kind of thing, because I was just sort of, I don't know, I was a bit intimidated by it. But I think actually it's a really important part of the process of taking ownership of it. It's not really yours until you understand, you know, what is under the carpets, what kind of joists does it have? What's it sort of, you know, what are all its little quirks? And you might think that is something that's running counter to the aesthetic of allowing some things to be in shadow. But I actually don't think it is, because I think that part of the reason why you might want to have shadows and make use of shadows is because it brings a sort of a more nebulous... I'm not quite sure how to phrase this. I don't think that the shadows that he is talking about are shadows of ignorance.
No.
It's more like the shadow is an aesthetic force within the space. And you are molding that shadow with skill using the space. So it doesn't imply a lack of control over the space or an ignorance of the space. It's more like a mastery of the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way he describes it, it is intentional. Like, it has to be very carefully designed to create these shadows. It's not just you can't illuminate them, it's you're choosing not to.
Yeah. So I think that I would take that from it, in the sense that illuminating every single corner of a house all the time is probably a sign of fear and paranoia about the house. Mm. Whereas allowing some bits to be in darkness shows a more comfortable mastery of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. You don't need to see it because you know what's there.
You know what's there.
Yeah.
But also there is this shadow that you're allowing to be there, and that shadow can have a presence that you feel in its own right, and that's a mysterious presence. But the mystery isn't the house. The mystery is the darkness.
Yeah.
That's how I would reflect on it.
Yeah.
That's probably a... Go on, sorry, plus.
Oh, plus the beauty it creates. And
the beauty, exactly.
Yeah.
Beauty is part of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I'm quite satisfied with that as a conclusion.
Yeah.
There's probably more to say.
I think there's lots more to say. I'm sure we'll keep coming back to it.
Yeah. It has the feeling like it's going to be one of those works that sort of gets referenced.
Yeah, I was saying when I was reading it, it wasn't so much the book itself, although that was great. It was the thoughts I was having while reading it.
Mm. He's got that ability to be quite unobtrusive and not particularly strident in his style. It's not like he's trying to beat you over the head with something.
Yeah, well, I think there's a thing in Japanese aesthetics of kind of suggesting something without directly talking about it, or like that's an effect that you're trying to go for with some dramas. Where the clearest description of something is something that doesn't actually describe it at all, but you talk about something adjacent, and then suddenly
the outline becomes clear.
And that's a really neat trick if you can pull it off.
Very good, very good. Well, I think I need to call it there because I'm. I think I need to go to bed. All this talk of shadows and is making me sort of.
I bet the Japanese got their 8 hours in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good to talk as always.
Yeah.
And whatever will it be next? What was it next that we were going to do next? We were saying that we had an idea.
Museums.
So stay tuned, everyone, for a fascinating podcast about museums coming up next.
Yeah.
See you later.